From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm Sarah Posner, filling in this week for your host, Welton Gaddy. On our interfaith calendar, Monday marks the Baha'i observance of the birth of the Bab, as well as the installation of scriptures as Gurkhru Granth for Sikhs. Tuesday is the start of the five-day Deepavali Festival of Lights for Hindus. On Thursday, Jains and Sikhs celebrate Diwali, and Friday is the Jain New Year. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
For the first time, praise for the homosexual and LGBT community and represents a clear break with the past. It appears the synod may also relax restrictions on divorcees attending communion. And with resistance to contraception softening, this synod may be the most radical since Vatican II in the 1960s.
With so much breaking news in recent weeks, not everyone may have noticed that a significant gathering of Roman Catholic bishops has just concluded at the Vatican, titled An Extraordinary General Synod, The Pastoral Challenges of the Family in the Context of Evangelization. The Synod has issued an interim report that many see as breaking new ground for the Church. On this week's show, we'll look at what all this means with author and historian Patricia Miller.
Talking about moderate and peaceful Muslims, I'm glad you're here. But where are the others speaking out?
I don't hear a lot of criticism from so-called moderate Muslims. So will you speak out?
Of course, yeah.
Let me hear you speak out then.
With the United States once again drawn into military conflicts in the Middle East, battling the spread of ISIS terrorist forces in Iraq and Syria, too many voices in this country continue to direct accusations and demands at Muslims in the U.S. and beyond. Some go further, insisting that Islam itself is inherently violent. Worst of all, some of those voices belong to purportedly religious leaders. An articulate response to that kind of rhetoric appeared recently in Religion Dispatches magazine, headlined, As a Muslim, I'm exhausted. The author is Nabil Achabi, and he'll be with us in this hour of State of Belief Radio. And I'll have a few sharp words to say about a church-state separation dust-up that happened this week in Texas. But first,
4 days of peaceful protest in the Missouri town of Ferguson have come to an end as a community and its supporters paid homage to African-American youths killed in recent weeks by police. But tempers flared at the end and some 50 arrests were made.
It's been more than 2 months since the deadly police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked community outrage and widespread protests. They have brought the uncomfortable issue of race in America back into the spotlight. At the same time, they have revealed how differently that issue is viewed by members of different racial groups. And the same goes for how each of us evaluates the criminal justice system itself. A week ago, a large group of activists, both local and from out of town, gathered for a weekend of resistance labeled Ferguson October, with support from the growing Moral Monday movement. And it was Monday that saw around 50 protesters, including a diverse group of faith leaders, arrested and charged with disturbing the peace. Joining us now is Pastor Mike McBride, who was jailed in Ferguson along with faith and secular leaders, including Dr. Cornell West. Pastor Mike is National Campaign Director of the Lifelines to Healing Campaign, part of the PICO network. Pastor Mike, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Great to be here with you. Thank you so much.
Would you start by just summarizing the events of this past weekend and into Monday and who the organizers were?
What is called Ferguson October, the Weekend of Resistance, was developed by a number of youth-led organizations and adult clergy allies on the ground and strategically placed across the country. Youth-led organizations like Hands Up United, the Organization for Black Struggle, Millennial Activists, the Lost Voices, a number of young people who have for 60-plus days been daily nonviolently protesting and calling for a more transparent system and process to justice for the killing of Mike Brown and most recently Von Derrick Myers. We, as the faith leaders and clergy who have some of us been there on the ground within the first week of the death of Michael Brown, joined in a powerful collaboration at their request and called faith leaders from across the country to come and join in an effort to lift up our moral voice. We had over 400 clergy join us, including Dr. Cornell West, Reverend Sekou, Reverend Renita, Pastor Tracy Blackman, Pastor Jamal Bryan, a number of clergy and faith leaders all across the country. And we were there together to listen, to hear, to be challenged by the young people, but also to express our moral outrage as faith leaders, provide an opportunity for repentance for ourselves, for showing up 60 days late, for the law enforcement agencies for engaging in acts that we believe are very oppressive and violent, and for certainly all of us as a larger community, so we can create some healing and bring justice to the region.
Why do you think it was important to add this level of visibility to these ongoing protests in Ferguson?
Well, I think people are failing to appreciate that this region, particularly St. Louis County, has a very, very troubled past, a very troubled legacy within the last couple of decades around police brutality. There are law enforcement officials who have been fired for falsifying reports, for engaging in police brutality, and then run for elected office. This has become institutionalized in the St. Louis County region, and the victims of the perpetuation of these policies continue to be poor Black young men and women, families who are often struggling to make ends meet. They are unable to move throughout the county freely because of focused policing that gives them bench warrants for moving violations, playing their music too loud, walking across the street outside of a crosswalk. It has created such distrust and such trauma, the killing of Mike Brown and all the witnesses and them leaving his body out there for 4 hours and the police cars coming, driving over the memorials later on in the day. I think it lit a fuse inside the hearts of these young people, and they said, we're not taking it anymore. It forced them then to say, you are not going to brush this under the rug like you've done so many times before. We're going to keep pushing for justice. And the visibility, in many respects, has created pressure to
right.
make sure that it is served.
Talk with me about the arrests. This is a longstanding tradition in civil rights activism. What purpose did it serve in this particular instance?
We believe that if there are laws that are on the books that are not just, then it is our duty as followers of Jesus, certainly I am a follower of Jesus, to not follow these laws. If those who are held responsible for enforcing these laws are not enforcing them justly, we believe it is our duty to resist to the point of violence, as we are all students and believers in nonviolence, to resist and expose the contradiction of the arrest. Though we certainly had planned and were prepared to be arrested, was only there to amplify the two sets of rules that are at play in the city of Ferguson.
Right.
We were there to make sure that it could be put on display all across the world, the lack of conversation, transparency, the lack of communication, the enforcement of the law at a very inconsistent manner, it creates and breeds lawlessness. We were asking to enter a public building. We were not given any direction, any conversation. We knew that it was within our civil rights that have been fought some 40 years ago that we have access to public buildings. And the arrest was intended to show, in many respects, a very moral contrast. Even the charges, the outlandish nature of the charges that we've been charged with assaulting police officers as we knelt down to pray when we were not able to move beyond the police line. These are all contradictions that are now on display for everyone to see. And it was done at the height of noon with all the cameras rolling and hundreds of witnesses. Can you imagine what is being done to our young people, our Black and brown men and women, in the nighttime when no cameras around and no one is there but the police officers and our young people? It is an outrage. It is immoral. And we all should be putting up our arms, our legs, and joining this very important civil rights movement and fight for justice and dignity.
So in addition to the arrests, was there another moment from last weekend that stood out for you as being memorable or emblematic of this being a new civil rights movement?
Honestly, I believe that while the arrest was the most public expression of the contradiction of the justice system, I will say that the most powerful and healing, and dare I say, a long-standing moment, happened the night before. There was a very important program that was called A Hip Hop and Hope, that Dr. Cornel West was the keynote speaker. And throughout the program, the number of speakers were largely clergy, older adults, civil rights leaders have flown in, and the young people were left pretty much in the stands and in the audience with only two representatives waiting to speak. In the middle of the program, the young people began to stand up, turn their backs. They began to do an action, if you will, a nonviolent but very public action on us, the adults, the clergy. It came to a point in which the young people were then invited on the stage and began to talk, and it was very painful to hear their thoughts and their rejection of our leadership and of our tactics. Some of it was laced with profanity. But the powerful moment was when the young people stayed, the elders, the clergy, the civil rights leaders stayed, and we covenanted and repented together to continue our work. That, I believe, has solidified the bridge, the intergenerational necessity of our relationships. And I believe it set the stage for the powerful work that was to come later on the next day, which was demonstrated by the young people themselves showing up to our rally after we had gotten arrested and leading 400 clergy in their chants and in their declarations for justice, ending with them yelling, "We love you," and the young people responding back, "And we love you," ending with the young people showing up to the jails to wait for the clergy, the same clergy that they cussed out the night before. They came to the jails and waited for all of us to be released. That, to me, was the most significant moment, I believe, in this movement so far. And I believe that if all of us all across the country can imagine ourselves withstanding the initial fire and frustration and anger of our young people, appreciating that they will not communicate with us at first the way we may want them to, but if we lean in and build relationship, we can restore the hearts of our mothers to our daughters, our fathers to our sons, of our clergy and churches to our community members. And this is, I think, the most powerful moment of the weekend.
Thanks for sharing that. That was a great story. So while you were in Ferguson and in your contact with law enforcement there, did you detect any progress on them scaling back their overly aggressive policing in reaction to all of these protests?
So I don't want to sound too critical here. I think maybe I should just temper my remarks by saying I work with at least a dozen police agencies across the country. I work with the Department of Justice. We teach and train community police relationships. We teach and train the Oakland Police Department and many others on race and on implicit bias and on excessive force. So we are very well, I am very well in relationship with national police chiefs in national cities. So I want to temper my remarks by saying that. The second thing I will say, I am convinced that there is a very, very under-resourced and under-trained police force in that region. I believe that their tactics and their approach are very heavy-handed. They are not consistent. They do not use the principles of transparency nor accountability that are important for a community and police relationship that is littered and grounded in historical racial trauma, pain, and brutality. So while we have lost the explicit militarized responses, I still believe that this police force in this region has a long way to go to be trained on 21st century best practices in policing. We are able, again, in the city of Oakland, to point to how in our communities we were averaging officer-involved shootings, not killings, but shootings every 6 to 8 weeks for the past 20 years or so. When our work as faith leaders and community members started 2 years ago, we've begun to not only reduce the gun violence incidents in our communities. We have not had an officer-involved shooting in 18 months in the city of Oakland because of the work that we have been able to do working with police and law enforcement and community members. So I'll say this about what needs to happen there. They need to be open to bringing in the best thinking experts and colleagues in law enforcement and community police relationships, helping them to develop better procedural justice strategies, better legitimacy strategies, better use of force strategies, better transparency strategies. And I believe until they do that, nothing that they are doing on their own will suffice, and it will continue to escalate into very dangerous situations, of which I have a great amount of fear, quite frankly.
Right, right.
when these announcements around the indictment or lack thereof come back.
Right, right. And you've shown in your own community that these kinds of practices are possible. So there's
absolutely
an example and a model. Right.
And not only possible, but effective. And you don't have to wait a whole generation. I'll say it again, the city of Oakland, in which we live, 2 years ago, we averaged 135 gun homicides. This year, we're down to about 60. We don't have officer-involved shootings anymore. We have reduced the number of arrests, while we have reduced the number of burglaries, number of armed robberies, all kinds of crime reductions, but community relationships have been strengthened. This is possible, but it requires skill, it requires heart, it requires commitment, it requires political leadership, of which we've seen none in that region. The governor's a Democrat. The people raising money for Darren Wilson are Democrats. The mayors are Democrats. The congresspeople are Democrats. Even our president and attorney general are Democrats. And they've done very little, in my estimation, to make sure that this is quickly resolved. We need leadership from the political structures. And if we don't get that, then we all will be responsible for the escalating tensions that I continue to be very concerned about.
Right. Pastor Mike, a few weeks ago, Robbie Jones of the Public Religion Research Institute was on this show telling Welton about how vast the statistical divide is between how white Americans and African Americans see our law enforcement system and our justice system. And what was really striking was that the shooting of Michael Brown had a big negative impact on African American responses to those questions, but hardly any impact on how white Americans answered. So if there continues to be this disconnect between these communities, how do you engage everyone to work together?
So we should not be surprised by this, particularly because if there is no proximity of relationship and even a location as relates to our folks, regardless of their culture, regardless of their economic background, people will experience the world differently. The reason why our communities experience it this way, number one, is because we are over-policed in our communities, which then continues to feed the criminalization narrative that all of us across the country, I think, have drunk from the wells and in many ways internalized. What we've done, and through our Live Free campaign and through the PICO Network, has intentionally attempted to engage people across race to have conversations and share stories, to enter into people's pain, to appreciate, again, that all of us have been victimized. I'd love to share another story while we were being processed. There were at least three members of the Justice Center who were processing our arrest who expressed to us, and they were all white, that they resented that they were being put in this position to even enforce these laws.
Wow.
They were feeling as if they were being forced to choose between doing the right thing and putting food on their table at night. And they encouraged us to keep doing what we're doing, but please be careful and protect ourselves. It is important to appreciate that structural racism oppresses everyone.
Right.
Not just the victims of violence, but even those who are being forced to fulfill roles in oppressive systems. It is critical for us then to find those allies, those stories, and lift them up, elevate them, so people do not feel as if this is not impacting them. Whether you are white, black, brown, whether you are gay or straight, whether you are rich or poor, all of these structural, racist, oppressive systems need to be dismantled so we all can live free and have the dignity that God has given to us. So this is our strategy, and we're working with evangelical organizations, CCDA, we're working with the Exponential Church Conference, we're working with Word Made Flesh, World Impact, Fuller Theological Seminary, I mean, a number of evangelical folks, largely white and Anglo, who are feeling the burning in their soul and realizing that we all must be evangelists of this gospel that includes justice and fairness for everyone, and that we're seeing great results.
Pastor Mike McBride is National Campaign Director of the Lifelines to Healing Campaign, part of the PICO Network. He leads the Way Christian Center in West Berkeley, California, and was one of the faith leaders arrested last week during the Days of Action in Ferguson, Missouri. Pastor Mike, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It has been my pleasure. God's blessings to us all.
I'm Sarah Posner, filling in this week for Welton Gaddy. Patricia Miller is an author and historian who brings a significant depth of knowledge to her writing about the Catholic Church. With a history stretching back for millennia, that's essential to any analysis of what's happening with the Church today. With the gathering of bishops known as an extraordinary general synod, the pastoral challenges of the family in the context of evangelization, just wrapping up at the Vatican, I'm very pleased to have Patty Miller with us on State of Belief. Patty, welcome.
Thank you, Sarah.
Let's start with the basics. What is a synod? How often does it happen, and how important is it?
Well, these extraordinary synods are important because they are truthfully extraordinary. They only happen at the discretion of the Pope, and he calls them at his pleasure. He gathers all the world's bishops together to discuss what he considers the most pressing issues for the Church. The last time the Catholic Church had a synod on family issues was actually in 1980, so that tells you how rare these events really are.
So who attended the synod?
It's all the world's bishops who are the official people who will draft the recommendations to the Pope. And then there's also some theologians and lay Catholics who are present as auditors, who are basically advisors to the process, but aren't really officially voting or contributing to the final document.
Got it. So I understand that there's a two-part nature of this gathering. Can you talk about that?
There is, and the Catholic Church does not like to move too quickly on anything. So there is this first synod, which is just concluding this Sunday, and that will produce a document of recommendations to the Pope that will then be discussed again next fall in Philadelphia at the second part of this synod. And at that point, it's believed that Pope Francis will make some formal recommendations about changes to pastoral practice or whatever it is he's considering as part of his overhaul of the family practices of the Church.
So we won't actually know the outcome for another year or so?
No. There will be a final document produced. There was an interim document released this week, which the bishops are currently apparently very vocally hashing out right now. And they will vote on that. I'm not sure if it's a straight up or down vote, if there's really, if it's a democratic process or if it's more of a, I think the committees are kind of jostling over the language at this point. And that document should be finalized by Monday. The synod formally concludes on Sunday. But those are just recommendations, so we won't know for a year how that plays out, really.
Patty, what parts of the synod's interim report are making the most headlines?
Well, the part that made the most headlines was the surprising language that the Church should open up the question of whether they could find a way to welcome homosexual people into the community of the Church, and similar language acknowledging that partnerships, same-sex partnerships, had value, that they provided each other with a lot of moral support. And that's an important admission for the Church because its previous language on homosexuality was that it is intrinsically disordered. So that was a big admission on their part. The latest wrinkle, however, is a new English translation of that document has just been released. And that translation, interestingly, changes the document from welcoming homosexual persons to providing for homosexual persons.
So the original document was written in Italian?
Yes.
And it didn't propose eliminating the intrinsically disordered language from church teaching, but rather laid over it this welcoming language.
Correct.
Was the immediate reaction to the welcoming language positive, or were there some conservatives reacting to it in a negative way?
It was certainly positive in the community of lesbian, gay, transgendered, and bisexual Catholics who were thrilled to even have that much recognition. It was not positive among conservatives who do rightly point out that the Church still has an official doctrine that says homosexuality should be condemned. And they expressed a lot of concern that this language is really confusing to Catholics about how homosexuals should be viewed by the Church.
So what do you think accounts for this new translation?
Well, that's the big question. It seems that the Vatican may be trying to walk that language back a bit, even ahead of the final report that will be published on this Monday. But it's not exactly clear. The Italian translation remains and is apparently still the official translation. So I think there's a lot of politics going on here. Conservatives were extremely concerned that the media reports about the positive nature of this language were kind of setting this change in stone before they had had a chance to vote on it and discuss it and finalize the document. So this may be an attempt to put some language out that's more to their liking, even ahead of the final document, but it is really an unfolding drama at this moment.
Next week on State of Belief Radio, an Italian translator. So tell me, are there people who are fluent in Italian looking at the document and looking at what the correct translation is?
There certainly is. There's Father James Martin, who writes for America Magazine, who's very well known,
sure.
Just posted on his Facebook page that indeed the word is welcoming, no matter how that is the Italian word for welcoming. That is
Got it.
That was not an incorrect translation in the first place. That would appear to be a political change, not a linguistic change. And so having two versions of that, I think the word people are using is muddles the issue at this point. It's just unclear what that really means.
And so when something like this comes out of the Vatican, this new translation, what triggers that? I mean, do you think that the Pope himself is taking a look at this, or is it the Vatican's press operation, or how does that transpire, do you think?
It more likely is the press operations. The Pope has been involved in some of the appointments to the committee drafting the document, but the press operations are more likely the people behind this, I would imagine. But, you know, the politics of all this, who controls the press operations and who gets their say in this translation and that translation, it is Byzantine, to say the least. It is the Vatican. It is not a transparent organization. There are lots of factions of people right now really jockeying for power. And so I think this kind of real-time drama being played out is something Catholics haven't seen in our lifetimes. It really is a divide in the church between the progressives and the conservatives being played out in real time. These kinds of divides have really been quashed for the past 35 years by both Popes John Paul II and Pope Benedict. They just did not allow this kind of public display of the divides within the church to happen. So it's really fascinating to see this happen in real time right now.
It's interesting that a lot of the mainstream coverage has focused on the theme of openness that seems to be the hallmark of the interim report. At the same time, the focus of the conservative media has been almost exclusively on the mainstream coverage as opposed to the Synod itself. How big is the change of direction when you look at that interim report?
I think the initial reaction came from some people who were very close to the church and who were really honestly kind of gobsmacked that language could even be used by people in the Roman Catholic Church at that level, because it really is a big change in rhetoric. But there's no change in doctrine suggested, and it really is a matter of the leadership of the church catching up to where the Catholic people have actually been for quite a long time. People would be maybe surprised to learn that Catholic Americans poll among the highest support for same-sex marriage when you break it out by religion in this country. Catholics of many parishes welcome gay and lesbian couples into their churches. So in terms of what's happening on the ground, it's really just catching up with practice. In terms of what's happening at the top level, it's a big change in rhetoric, but more because it's a change almost from really draconian language that's not even representative of the 20th century anymore. So you have to be a little careful how much credit you give the church for changing something when you're starting from such kind of a backwards attitude in some ways.
A lot of the news coverage has focused on the document reflecting, if not the views of Pope Francis, his style, his more open style. How collaborative is this gathering at the Vatican? Are they dealing with dissent? Does pretty much everybody there, are they on the same page with one another?
They really are not on the same page, Sarah. There was several of the conservative bishops who really were against any changes, even in the pastoral application of some of the issues regarding divorce and communion. Did something rather unprecedented right before the synod started. They published their own books basically arguing against any changes, whereas Cardinal Casper, who is considered Pope Francis's closest ally and the closest to his voice, direct voice in the synod, published his own book arguing for a change, at least in the pastoral application of some of these doctrines. So they went into this at odds, and with the cardinals, who were more conservative, having staked out publicly a position in opposition to what was believed to be the Pope's wishes. So there was some contention even going into this, and that contention seems to be playing out as the synod progresses.
And just to be clear, the pastoral application refers to welcoming LGBT couples or welcoming LGBT people, notwithstanding the teaching and the welcoming language as it was originally translated from the Italian was a reflection of that pastoral versus doctrinal application of...
Exactly. And it's really, pastoral is really the practice, you know, how that would play out in the parishes on a day-to-day basis, not the rule book. And Pope Francis seems to be saying, we have some leeway here, we can keep those rules on the books, but how that looks in the real lives of Catholics and how that's really applied by the bishops and the priests in the parishes, there's some leeway there to be more welcoming to people and to, as he keeps saying, to apply some mercy to individual situations, to not take such a hard line that if you're an imperfect Catholic, you're kind of excluded from the church.
Right. And that has pretty much been the hallmark of Francis's papacy, focusing more on these pastoral situations where the priest or the bishop is encountering a flawed human being like everyone else, and that they should be, like you said, deal with these situations with more mercy as opposed to being doctrinally correct.
That's exactly right. He said famously he sees the church as a field hospital after battle. You have people suffering from divorce, and the church being a way to help them rebuild their lives and recover and find God again after being divorced, their attitude seems to be, why would you turn people in need away from the church? Those are exactly the people who need the church. Whereas the more authoritarian hardliners, they really want to use the sacraments especially as somewhat of a stick. You know, if you want to get communion, if you want to be married in the church, we want to see perfect practice before you walk in the door. And the progressives are saying that's not a realistic in most people's lives. It's not merciful. It's really not the main job of the church to police people. It's to offer them, you know, this mercy and this grace. So it really is two pretty radically different ways of seeing the purpose and the practice of the Catholic Church.
How do you think that divide is ultimately going to get resolved, or is it going to get resolved?
Well, these past few days have shown how difficult it could be to resolve that divide. I think Pope Francis has taken an extremely moderate position. He certainly isn't pushing for changes in doctrine, and he seems to have really looked for some common ground, especially around divorce and communion, where everyone could agree these are ways we could extend a more welcoming attitude towards Catholics. That and the ban on contraception seem to be the two doctrinal issues that really just push people away from the church. So he's really tried to find common ground. It's not clear that the conservative faction is going to go there with him. He is the Pope, and at the end of the day, he can kind of do what he wants to do, which when the conservatives were in power, they were very gleeful about. You know, they always said the Pope's the Pope, and he makes the rules, and if you don't like it, you can leave. Well, now that Pope Francis is in charge and the conservatives don't like the rules, they're suddenly not so crazy about that structure.
Right.
But I think he's really trying hard to build common ground. So there is a sense of the bishops finding agreement and moving forward together. But I have to tell you, the way this looks, they are not making this easy for him at this moment.
Patty Miller is a historian and scholar. She is the author of the book Good Catholics, The Battle Over Abortion in the Catholic Church. Patty's writing appears frequently in Religion Dispatches, The Nation, The Huffington Post, and elsewhere. Patty, this has been so helpful. Thank you for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Sarah.
Filling in for Welton Gaddy this week, I'm Sarah Posner. As a Muslim, I'm exhausted, .. That's the headline in Nabila Chabi's recent article published in Religion Dispatches magazine. For those of us who do not face daily demands that we personally respond in some way to the horrors of ISIS terror threats, it's an invaluable reminder of what it means to be a Muslim in America today. And I'm very pleased that it brings Nabila Chabi to State of Belief Radio. Nabil, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You write that the simplistic good Muslim versus bad Muslim paradigm is having a destructive effect on the community. Start with that, please.
Sure. Well, I think we have been told for a long time by non-Muslims and Muslims, and I would say that both of those parties are very well-meaning in their attempt to try to rectify some of the biases of the coverage of Muslims, not only here in the United States, but all over the world, particularly after 9/11, to try to counter this negative portrayal of Islam with positive images and positive narratives. And what I'm arguing in this piece is that I think that these positive narratives can be as equally damaging as the negative portrayals because they reify this trope of narratives about Muslims as speaking only as agents of their faith, that Muslims speak only as Muslims and nothing else. And I was literally exhausted. I have been for a while. I was one of those people who thought at the beginning that that's how you counter these lingering images and narratives about Muslims. But then it dawned on me that we are just perpetuating a very stagnant view of Islam and of Muslims all over the world, by the way.
You seem to be saying that a lot of Muslims have been trapped by a fear of being multidimensional or even flawed, as we all are, human beings.
Yes, because in this attempt to retrieve some sort of a perfect sanitized Muslim, to counter the images, the totalizing images of Muslims, whether it's in the news or in popular culture, we have really built this idea of a perfect Muslim. And the more we do this, I think the more we trap ourselves in that narrative. And as well-meaning as organizations as CARE and ISNA and many other organizations, not only here in the U.S. but all across the world, they are also reifying these images, and they are making Muslims look like they are very unidimensional, that they are devout Muslims who pray, who do this, who do that, but not really give a very complex, multidimensional representation of what Muslims can do away from the lens of piety. This is not the only thing that defines who we are. We do other things. We speak from different vantage points, and we cannot be reduced always to this idea that we are moral beings who are constantly looking to react to the immorality of the world, because that makes us look like we are some perfect being who are not living in the world in the first place.
Your headline is a take on the Reddit as a Muslim ... meme. That's kind of what you're talking about, breaking out of a sanitized version of being publicly Muslim. Can you describe that campaign?
Absolutely. I mean, that as a Muslim, I condemn Ebola really captured the essence of what I'm trying to say here. We have condemned and we have apologized so much and so often that our condemnations and our apologies really don't serve us any good. If someone wants me to apologize first before I speak as a Muslim, I find that very problematic. They are basically saying that the only condition for me to be accepted into the realm of talking about anything is for me first to apologize about what other Muslims could be doing somewhere else. I mean, I could ask the same question, I won't, but it's almost akin to asking the same question of a Christian, telling them, well, if there is a militant Christian who decides they want to bomb an abortion clinic, and they did, would you want first and foremost to apologize for what they did as a Christian before we can have any kind of conversation in the first place? And I find that very similar here. I think the frustration has been that we are seen and perceived as agents of our own faith, and we can speak only if we apologize, only if we condemn. And because our images and narratives and presence in the media is far and between when it comes to entertainment, when it comes to good, complex conversations about Islam and anything else, the only presence that we have is this kind of presence where we are brought in just to defend ourselves and to prove ourselves and prove to the world, particularly the non-Muslim world, that we are not those guys. We're not ISIS. We're not these barbarians. We don't do these kinds of things. Our faith is a faith of peace. And we play into that trap over and over and over again. And it doesn't really help that much. That, at least, is my argument. And I think the sentiment of the Reddit campaign was very similar to mine, and saying that it's actually so ridiculous that as Muslims, we are going to say that we condemn Ebola as well. I am here really reminded by a beautiful segment from the Hijabi Monologues group in Ireland of this woman who is veiled, and she's talking about how she's exhausted to be taken as the emblem of an entire religion and of a 1.2 billion people. And then she's really asking that question herself, why is it that you're looking at me as this Muslim almost prototype, right? You deploy me for everything. So she's talking about her friends who are asking her a question about, explain to us here what it means that Muslims have to go on jihad, and explain to us what it means to wear the veil. And if she's looking a little bit down, they must be making all kinds of assumptions that she might not be liberated, that she's oppressed, or if she's not saying something really smart, then they might think of her as someone who is just, you know, memorizing things and not thinking for herself. And after what happened with Bill Maher and Sam Harris and Ben Affleck, and then the New York Times really asking that question in that room for debate, where they asked a variety of Muslims to articulate a little bit if Muslims should be defending their faith against extremism. Then I said, you know, that's it. I mean, every single thing that happens, we have to condemn it, we have to apologize for it, and we have to bring out our good Muslims. We have to bring out our sanitizers. It's almost like they're waiting in a room, and you can deploy them. And that's not who we are. I mean, we should not be trying to provide something that is so put together, that is so perfect, that is so stable. Our stories are as problematic and as fractured as anybody else's. And we should be proud of that, and we should be exposing more of that frailty in our human experience, more so than our perfection as moral beings. I'm not saying that people should cease doing these things and should cease talking about these things, but I'm just saying that I think at this point in time, it's far more urgent for us to really start talking about other things other than our faith and our religion. And it's not only this group. I mean, many other groups. I mean, look at the Jewish experience in this country. Look at the African-American experience in this country. I mean, we need to follow the examples of this. And I think that if we look a little bit more closely and historically at these other groups, we might find really good lessons to learn from, because that's the only way we can help assuage really this plight, this problem of representation of Muslims.
I think in light of the Reddit meme and of your article's headline, it might be really valuable to have you complete the sentence fully. As a Muslim, ...
I am still exhausted, I would say. As a Muslim, I feel that my faith is important, but it's not the only thing that is important about me. As a Muslim, I feel that my voice is not completely represented. There are many Muslims who don't see themselves in this binary of good Muslim versus bad Muslim. It sets up a very high and unreachable bar for us as human beings, and we should be just like anybody else, not trying to cling to some kind of perfection, and really get down and say, you know, our lives are just as messy as anybody else's, and we need to acknowledge that, and we need to say it and be proud of it. We are just like anybody else. Yes, we have a faith that we believe in and that we think is great and is exemplary and all of those things, but there are other people who have also their faith, and their faith is telling them the same thing. But we do other things, and I would like, as a Muslim, I would like those other things to be also part of the story.
Nabil Achabi is Associate Professor in Media Studies and Associate Director of the Center for Media, Religion, and Culture at the University of Colorado Boulder. His Religion Dispatches piece is headlined, "As a Muslim, I'm Exhausted." It's well worth reading, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com.
Well, thank you. This is a wonderful conversation, and thank you again for inviting me to talk about my piece.
Before we go, much of my week as a journalist covering religion and politics was consumed by a story that exploded in Houston, Texas. A quick summary. The city council approved a human rights ordinance granting some dignity in public accommodations to transgender persons. You know, the right to use the appropriate restroom and things like that. An opposition movement quickly developed, led by conservatives who have long fought pro-LGBT initiatives in the city, including many purportedly Christian leaders. There was a petition drive to put the ordinance to a public vote on a referendum. Then the city attorney invalidated many of the signatures on the petition, and the referendum initiative died. The conservatives sued the city, and then, in a move as overzealous as my corgi chasing a bunny out of the yard, city attorneys decided to subpoena everything from conservative faith leaders who were not even parties to the lawsuit, everything that they had said, preached, texted, or sermonized about sexual minorities and LGBT rights. Terrible legal strategy? A constitutional mess? Or a failure to foresee the most predictable political reaction? The far right is building the midterm campaign on claims that Christianity is under attack in this country. Houston's attorneys handed the religious right a gift on a silver platter. It's like a made-for-TV movie that Rick Santorum's production company would have made if they had thought of it. The mayor? Openly gay. The ordinance? Not even enacted yet. The subpoenas? Blatantly unconstitutional. You can read my reporting on this over at Religion Dispatches. No surprise, Welton had a quotable response to all of this in an open letter he wrote to Houston's mayor, Anise Parker. That's why I quoted him in my column, and I want to quote him here on his own show. He said, quote, "I will work as hard to defend the freedom of speech from the pulpit for those with whom I disagree as I will to defend the rights of the LGBT community. As long as a sermon is not inciting violence, the government has no business getting involved in the content of ministers' sermons." End quote. The mayor's office has been working hard to distance itself from this subpoena, blaming city lawyers for the overreach. But let's hope a lesson about religious freedom has been learned, because sadly, for this election cycle at least, it's too late for any lesson in culture war politics. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. It's been an honor to sit in for Welton Gaddy. Thank you for listening. Now to wrap up, I'll turn things over to producer Ray Kirstein.
Our thanks to journalist Sarah Posner. Read her work at Religion Dispatches, Al Jazeera America, and elsewhere, as well as at sarahposner.com. Sarah hosts a popular program at Blogging Heads TV and is the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Welton Gaddy will be back next week. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue they can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, and watch in-studio videos, as well as read transcripts and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. The listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen, too. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics, only here on State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man.